possible here for them. So they've begun to think, maybe there's a better place for me to do my science outside of the United States. Maybe in a country like Canada or in the EU or China to do that work. And that's having a really, really devastating effect on the scientific community, because people are really worried that they'll begin to lose really brilliant individuals, really talented young scientists, away, like sort of going away from this country and beginning to investigate, you know, disease and other health issues outside of the U.S. That potentially could have the result of the U.S. losing its dominance, sort of its place in as a leader in biomedicine in the world.
Angus Chen, we want to thank you for being with us, cancer reporter at STAT, following the impact of the Trump administration's executive orders on science and health. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I want to turn to Dr. Ruth Fadin in Washington, D.C., the founder of the Berman Institute of Bioethics, biomedical ethics professor at Johns Hopkins University. From 1994 to 1996, she served as chair of the National Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments, established by President Clinton. She has just co-authored a new piece in STAT headlined, "The Abrupt End of USAID-Funded Clinical Trials is Profoundly Unethical." In it, she writes, "The path from the atrocities of Nuremberg and Tuskegee to today's robust ethics of medical research has not been easy." She continues, quote, "In response to these horrific events, a remarkable global consensus emerged across countries in very different parts of the world and with very different types of governments. Medical researchers and the institutions and companies who fund their work are bound by a series of ethical obligations. These obligations are designed to protect and respect the interests of people who participate in their research. They include minimizing foreseeable harms to participants and keeping the promises that researchers make to study volunteers. While the fate of USAID remains murky, one thing is absolutely clear. The abrupt termination of critical USAID-funded clinical trials with insufficient time to safeguard the welfare of people who are participating is profoundly unethical and utterly inexcusable." Dr. Fadin and Dr. Nancy Cass write. Dr. Fadin, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can explain exactly what you mean, whatever happens with USAID, what about these medical subjects, people around the world, to explain what clinical trials are and what it means for the doctors and the researchers to get a stop work order that means they cannot get their medicine or have some medical device removed or put in at the moment that it is supposed to happen.
Thank you, Amy. And I'm going to do my best to unpack this issue for everybody listening. You've already sort of expressed much of the general concern. So let me try to make it more granular. When people are asked to participate in a clinical trial, and this is true anywhere in the world, and it is certainly true of USAID-funded research, two things happen. First, there is assurance to the people who are thinking about whether or not to participate, that their interests are going to come first, that people are going to make sure the clinicians, the nurses that are running the trials, that they'll do their very best not to harm participants. And the other is that we're going to keep our promises to you. You're going to take on some risk by participating in a clinical trial that will ostensibly benefit many other people, as well as potentially yourself. And in exchange for your taking on that risk, we're going to do everything we can to protect your interests. Now, that's the background sort of ethical playing field in which research with human subjects is acceptable. When you have a sudden, abrupt cessation of work on a clinical trial, you blow all of that out of the water. Why is that? When a person's participating in clinical research, imagine yourself in a cancer clinical trial. I'm thinking about your conversation with Angus just a minute ago. It is often the case that that clinical trial is giving you your cancer treatment. It's the only way you're getting medical care through that clinical trial. Now, if that clinical trial is on a dime, stopped, what happens to you? Where do you go? What does that mean? Similarly, if you're in a clinical trial that's testing out, I don't know, a new device to prevent HIV transmission or a new device to deal with heart arrhythmias, and you're going regularly, it's an experimental device, and you're going every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks to be monitored to make sure that your health is still okay. Now, all of a sudden, there's a work stop order, and you've got an experimental device implanted on your body, in your body. You can't take it out on your own. Now what happens? What this sudden, abrupt dismantling, and it's a mess. We don't know what's going to happen with USAID in the end, right? What it has resulted in is, for the first time in a very long time, research funded and conducted by Americans. We're in a situation in which we're going to leave people abandoned. And that's utterly ethically unacceptable.
Dr. Ruth Fadin, we're going to come back to you at another time to talk about everything from Tuskegee to Nuremberg, to talk about the implications of this. But I want to thank you right now for giving us a preview of what we are looking at in this country and around the world. Dr. Ruth Fadin is founder of the Berman Institute of Bioethics, biomedical ethics professor at Johns Hopkins University. We'll link to her piece, The Abrupt End of USAID-Funded Clinical Trials, Profoundly Unethical. When we come back, the Democratic Republic of Congo, back in 20 seconds.
Whisper, listen, whisper, say we're free. Rumors flying, must be lying, can it really be? Can't conceive it, can't believe it, but that's what they say. Slave no longer, slave no longer.
Freedom Day by Max Roach and Abby Lincoln. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where M23 fighters have entered Bukavu, the second largest city in eastern Congo. M23's latest advance in the region marks the group's most significant expansion of territory since the fighting began in 2022. The Congolese government reported Rwandan troops were also on the ground. This comes as the African Union gathers in Ethiopia, where leaders urge for a ceasefire in the DRC to avoid a regional escalation. For more, we're joined by Kambale Musabuli. He is a native of the Democratic Republic of Congo, now based in Accra, Ghana, leading political and cultural Congolese voice, policy analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo-Kinshasa. His latest piece for People's Dispatch is titled, The Battle for Control of Goma Continues. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Kambale. If you could just talk about the significance of this moment, what's at stake in the DRC?
What is happening right now is that the M23 have taken over the city of Bukavu. Before that, they were taking over a few cities where the minerals are. And it's causing quite a lot of tension in the city. People that we know, most of them are not in harm's way, but they are worried about what will happen to them. Like, for example, people at Panzi Hospital with Dr. Mukwege, who's been very vocal about the situation in the Congo. And the doctors in the hospital. But for us, the current situation is not the first time this has happened. Since 1996, for the past 30 years, we've seen over a period of time uprising of the same rebel group with different names. But what stopped them, right, the M23 in 2012, was international pressure. We're not seeing the same type of international pressure now. Even though we have information that in the city of Goma, for example, where the battle took place, over 3,000 Congolese were killed in the city. There are over 3,000 bodies there. And now with the taking over of Bukavu, not knowing if they're going to move into other cities, the international pressure is not the same as in 2012.
And And can you talk about, I mean, for the world right now, and we're going to be going into this Oscar-nominated film, Soundtrack of a Coup d'Etat. Kambali, you have seen this film. It goes back to 1961. It goes back to the assassination of Lumumba. It goes to the resources in a country that are needed. What does Democratic Republic of Congo provide something like, what, 40, more than 40% of the world's coltan, Western countries desperate to control it?
Congo is really at the heart of the fourth industrial revolution. You know, I've often said that you cannot talk about AI without Congo's cobalt, Congo's coltan, Congo's lithium. He actually also has one of the largest lithium reserves in the world. So when we talk about the militia group, we are also missing the point that this battle is coming out of a context, right? The control of Congo's vast mineral wealth. Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat is a great film. It shows us that what happened in 1960 is still happening now. Right? The battle in 1960 was the control of Congo's uranium and Congo's cobalt during the so-called Cold War. And in that film, what I appreciate the filmmaker did was to show us the different protagonists and also lift up the names of Africans who were at the side of the Congolese at the time, the African-American community, Max Roach, Maya Angelou, Amiri Baraka, to the Africans on the continent, such as André Blois. But one element in that film that I'm lifting up for the current context today is the story of Louis Armstrong in the DRC. Right? Louis Armstrong was in the Congo when Patrice Lumumba was arrested by antagonist forces supported by Belgium, the CIA, and so forth. In the film, you are able to see how the CIA worked with the State Department to travel with Louis Armstrong in the DRC to be able to monitor what was happening in Katanga when Patrice Lumumba was arrested.
And Kambali,
to understand also the role of artists.
You have introduced the film perfectly because we're going to go to the director right now, but we want to come back to you in the coming days to talk more specifically about what's happening in the DRC. But an amazing introduction to this Oscar-nominated film. Kambali Musavuli, native of the Democratic Republic of Congo, we're speaking to him in Accra, Ghana. We turn now to the Oscar-nominated documentary Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, told entirely through archival footage. The film's a sweeping story of the events leading up to the pivotal chapter in Congo's history, the 1961 assassination of the Congolese president, the independence leader, Patrice Lumumba. The film tracing the long, brutal history of mineral exploitation in Congo from the time when Congo was a possession of the Belgian King Leopold II all the way to the conflict minerals of today, showing the power of the mining industry, highlighting the role of the Belgian mining company, Union Minière, in the overthrow and murder of Lumumba. Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat features several key leaders at the time, including President Eisenhower, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, former U.N. Secretary General Doug Hammarskjöld, as well as the jazz legends Abby Lincoln, Max Roach, Nina Simone, Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong. This is a trailer.
One of America's most popular emissaries arrives in the troubled Congo on the State Department's goodwill mission. Louis Stalin swinging outraged Radio Moscow, which blasted Armstrong's visit as a diversionary tactic.
The people of the Congo are entitled to build up their country in peace and freedom.
Hold me close and hold me fast.
We were to go to Elizabeth Zell to attend a concert given by Louis Armstrong.
How much money do the Central Intelligence Agency has poured into the Congo?
I don't know. Are you prepared to say?
I certainly, of course, don't know. I wonder if it's quite honest to represent our policy as completely angelic. When
you and seated out on the terrace was a man I recognized. He said, well, you have to assassinate Lumumba.
He used those words?
Yes.
But who ordered him?
He said, President Eisenhower.
In the UN, when Khrushchev took off his shoe and was beating that shoe, and the interpreter said, I'll marry you, talking about America. Khrushchev was saying, I love you, but it was the interpreter who hated America. You understand what I mean?
But did he have rhythm?
Rhythm them is my business.
Death to colonial slavery. Bury it. Bury it deep in the ground. The deeper, the better.
The trailer for Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. I just interviewed the director of the film, the Belgian filmmaker Johan Grimompré, and began by asking him why he made it.
Well, it roots back in the ignorance, not knowing and growing up in Belgium, but not learning that story in school. And so here we have war being privatized and the template of a corporatocracy that is dictating what sort of happens in the war industry. You could actually project that template exactly on what was going on with that pivotal moment when Congo became independent. And so it's the mining industry, specifically in Union Minière, going back to Société Générale, that was actually complicit in the overthrow of Patrice Lumumba and ultimately, subsequently, its assassination.
Tell us the story of King Leopold and the Congo, and then Congo's independence.
Well, for example, Union Minière d'Haut-Katanga was a private company by Leopold II. The Free State of Congo was his personal property. And so what we see in that sort of moment towards independence, still sort of a lot of stuff is lingering. The Union Minière was actually having a huge hold over the country. And so when Patrice Lumumba became the first independent leader of the Congo, Union Minière concocted, or actually succeeded in the province of Katanga, installing a marionette president, Moshe Tshombe, to actually get back at Patrice Lumumba reconquering the Congo in a sort of a neo-colonial grab. You know, people talk about post-colonialism, but actually it's a misnomer. What was sort of the ground zero of how the West was about to deal with the riches of the African continent was actually the assassination of Patrice Lumumba.
And talk about what the black U.S. jazz musicians have to do with the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Well, the context is that we have the 15th General Assembly, right? 16 African countries are admitted to the world body, and it actually causes a global shift, a political earthquake within that world body, where 16 African countries actually make that the global shift, sort of the Afro-Asian bloc suddenly gains the majority vote in the United Nations.
They become independent countries, these African countries.
They are admitted to the world body as independent countries, and it shifts the global vote. The Afro-Asian bloc is actually gaining the majority vote. And so we have East and West sort of trying to wrestle control over the United Nations General Assembly. Nikita Khrushchev would introduce the decolonization resolution to get the global south on his case. Nikita Khrushchev, the then Soviet premier of Russia. And then we have the United States, ruled by President Eisenhower, would send in arm twisters to actually buy up votes within the United Nations General Assembly. But also, subsequently, 1 month later, they would send black jazz ambassadors into the Congo. It was the United States Information Agency already before was sending black jazz ambassadors.
So USIA, the U.S. Information Agency, is sending black jazz musicians to the Congo.
It was a strategy that was already mid-50s. It was a way to actually win the hearts and minds of the global south. But I discovered that, for example, Dizzy Gillespie was sent to Syria. Underneath, you had actually the CIA buying up the Syrian government. Like with Louis Armstrong arriving in the Congo 1 month after the General Assembly, the United's 15th General Assembly, you see that actually the United States, in cohorts with the Belgian intelligence, is actually plotting to overthrow the Lumumba government and also subsequently assassinating Patrice Lumumba.
I want to actually go to that moment at the end of the film. It's announced that Patrice Lumumba has been assassinated, and we'll talk about who is involved with his assassination. But it's from February 15th, 1961, when protesters led by the jazz great Abbie Lincoln, led by Max Roach and the great writer Maya Angelou, stormed the UN Security Council to protest the murder of Patrice Lumumba.
Shall the United Nations survive? Shall the attempt to bring about peace by the concerted power of international understanding be discarded?
an incredible moment. You bigoted MFers, they're yelling, they're comparing them to the KKK. And that was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, under John F. Kennedy. He was giving his maiden speech.
And it was immediately interrupted by 60 protesters, lead by Abby Lincoln, the jazz singer. In sort of conjunction with the Women's Rights Coalition in Harlem, amongst Maya Angelou and Rosa Guy, and they crashed to secure the council to protest the murder. This is 3 days. You have to know that Patrice Lumumba was murdered 3 days before President Kennedy became president as well. And so...
He was elected, but it was January 17th, so it's before his inauguration,
exactly.
Right? So this is
exactly.
Under Eisenhower this took place.
Exactly.
The previous
But the protest,
president.
Because they kept it quiet 1 month, and then it was announced at the Security Council, 15th of February 1961.
So... The soundtrack, of course, it's called Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. The soundtrack of this documentary, the jazz greats of the United States, and as you talked about, recruited by the USIA, the U.S. Intelligence Agency, to play in Africa. So talk about their role, like Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, and what they understood they were being used for.
When you see that actually the black jazz ambassador was sent out as a cover for actually coup d'etats that were plotted underneath, hence also the title, Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. So you have Louis Armstrong actually upon invitation by Strelitz, who was the CEO of Union Minière, the company that actually propped up Moshe Tshombe, the then Marionette president in Katanga, which was used to secede from Lumumba's sort of Greater Congo and to actually cause a rift. We have Patrice Lumumba, Louis Armstrong arriving third week of October, and then he comes back in Katanga third week of November. You have to know, actually, he was staying at Moshe Tshombe's, the then Marionette president at Katanga, in his house. And so that night they have dinner, Larry Devlin, Louis Armstrong, U.S. Ambassador Timberlake.
Wait, explain who Larry Devlin was.
Larry Devlin was head of the CIA. But unbeknownst to Louis Armstrong, to him he was an agricultural advisor. That was his cover name. And there is also U.S. Timberlake, and we have the Belgian advisors, that's Ramon Linden, who was the African minister, Belgian African minister. And he's sitting at the table. But still, you know, you would think that they would be sent out as passive instruments of promoting democracy, which is very schizophrenic because back home they were not allowed to vote. They were still second-rate citizens.
You mean the jazz musicians were not allowed to vote in the United States?
Exactly. It's very schizophrenic. You know, it's very schizophrenic. But it's not because they are used as propaganda instruments to promote democracy. They actually were very much also... You know, not passive agents. You know, he would grill Moshe Tshombe and say, "You're in bed with big money. You know, you have to take some and give some." Or he would refuse to go play for an apartheid audience in South Africa. Or he would change the lyrics. I think that's very subtle. He would change the lyrics in the song that he also sung when he visited Ghana and sung for Kwame Nkrumah, the first independent leader of Ghana. The Black and Blue label, he would sing instead of "I'm white inside," he would change the words "I'm right inside." Or even at one moment with the Little Rock, he would be very outspoken and refuse to go as a diplomatic ambassador to Russia and say, you know, and it's quoted from the New York Times, you know, he said the government can go to hell. So he was very outspoken in 1957. Later on, it was a bit more tricky because his concert was still being bombed, for example, in Knoxville, after he came back from Africa by white suprematists.
One of the people who worked as an advisor on this film worked on Raoul Peck's great 2000 film, Lumumba. That was like a quarter of a century ago. What new information has come out? You mentioned Larry Devlin, CIA, Eisenhower, the president of the United States at the time. What did the CIA and Eisenhower have to do with Lumumba's murder?
Well, a lot of new data came out with the publication of Ludo de Wit's book, The Assassination of Patrice Lumumba, 1999, that actually also the United Nations, and more specifically Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld, was complicit in this whole affair of the downfall of Patrice Lumumba. Of
course, Dag Hammarskjöld was the UN Secretary General at the time.
At the time. he was complicit with the downfall of Lumumba and ultimately the capture, but then also the assassination. Then also the monarchy was in the know about what was going on, that Lumumba was about to be sent over to Katanga. Mobutu was in the know. The Belgian Sûreté at the time was called, the Belgian intelligence was involved, and they actually labeled Patrice Lumumba as a communist to get the United States on their car, in their camp on the cause. And so President Eisenhower was afraid that the NATO, sort of the Western Union of countries that would fall apart, he actually sided with the colonial countries, in essence, right? And so he, you know, at the time, he, you know, that came out in the Church Committee in 1976. There was a hearing in the mid-70s where a lot of that stuff came out. First, there was actually the plotting to actually get rid of Fidel Castro, but then they changed gear, and then Patrice Lumumba became a priority because they were afraid he would become sort of siding with Nikita Khrushchev, the then Soviet premier. And so they all banded together to actually assassinate him. And this was the first democratically leader of the Congo. And why? Because at the beginning of the film, you hear Patrice Lumumba literally saying, I'm not a communist or a socialist. I'm actually African. I'm first of all a sovereign leader who actually chooses that the riches of the country also benefit the country. And at the end of the film, you see the conclusion of Malcolm X as well. He says, you know, it's not socialism or Marxism or communism they're afraid of, it's Africanism. It's actually leader choosing to stand up and choosing that the riches would also come back to the population. But if you look at sort of what it's the Congolese algorithm, the Belgian Congolese writer Nkole Jean-Bofani, he would sort of what he would call the template, the Congolese algorithm, that actually all conflicts that were used in all major wars of the 20th century were sourced from the Congo, be it copper, be it uranium, rubber in the beginning of the First World War, uranium in the Second World, because it was high-grade uranium, like 3,000 ton that was used in the Manhattan Project came actually from Katanga, from the east.
And how did the U.S. get it to make the atomic bombs, the uranium from Katanga, from the Congo?
It was ultimately a deal with Henry Spaak, because, you know, Belgium was overrun by the Germans, and so we had a Nazi government at that time. So the king fled, and then Spaak, the prime minister, fled to London, and together with Churchill and Roosevelt, the president of United States, they actually sort of made a deal that all uranium from the Belgian Congo would actually be part of the Manhattan Project, basically. And, you know, that was 3,000 ton, 70% high-grade uranium. Half of that was still above ground when Lumumba took power. So that was part of the equation, what was going on in Katanga.
That's Belgian filmmaker Johan Grimompré, director of Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, which has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. Told entirely through archival footage, the film's a sweeping story of the events leading up to the assassination of the Congolese independence leader, first Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. To see the whole interview, go to democracynow.org. You can also see other interviews Democracy Now! Has conducted about other films nominated for this year's Oscar, including the Palestinian-Israeli film No Other Land, also nominated for Best Documentary about the Palestinian community of Masafer Yatta, which was recently attacked by Israeli settlers. There's also the best short documentary, I Am Ready, Warden, about the death penalty that began when a Texas man asked journalist Kerry Blakinger to witness his execution. And The Apprentice, nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor, the film many say Trump doesn't want you to see, that looks at how Trump was mentored by Roy Cohen, former chief counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy during the Red Scare. He mentored as he built his New York real estate empire. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Cooperatives and Mutuals Canada is honored to host the annual CMC Congress from June 10 to June 12 at the Hotel Saskatchewan in Regina, Saskatchewan. Under this year's theme, The Future is Co-op, join us for thought-provoking plenaries and participate in interactive workshops and breakout sessions. To learn more or register, please visit www.canada.coop now.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.